The art of self-reliance is forging your own path, but the path is difficult. Made easier by learning from those who have succeeded in directing their own lives on their own terms. With their help and inspiration, your path to self-reliance moves from dream to reality. And now, here's your host, Dr. Rodney King.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Art of Self-Reliance podcast. In this episode, I speak to neuroscientist Kushik Ram. Kushik's focus as a neuroscientist is on the brain-body connection. His mission is to teach others how they can strengthen their nervous system and train the intelligence of the heart to thrive in an era of rapid change, complexity, and ambiguity. His goal is to take the guesswork out of the hustle and exhaustive strategies and learn how to work with the precision of the moment. In this episode, we discuss the paradox of the reptilian brain, the link between instinct and flow, and how to biologically unlock the intelligence of the heart.
The art of self-reliance calls you to adventure, to develop your self-protection skills, to learn how to survive no matter where you find yourself, and to thrive amongst life's chaos.
So Kushik, here's my first question for you. When you hear the words self-reliance, what does that mean to you?
Wow, that's a big one. Self-reliance for me is being fully self-sufficient. And I know it's a big one to pull out because in current society, we are so dependent on the systems that are around us, and everything from supply chains for food to how we take care of ourselves, everything is outsourced. So to be self-reliant is to, for me, to be fully integrated with nature in its own ecosystem and not be dependent on anything outside it.
Yeah, I think that's beautiful. I mean, that, I think we're in alignment there, and that definitely is something that concerns me a lot, is that how we are so reliant on external sources of our sense of control that most of us really no longer rely on ourselves. And heaven forbid, especially in the Western world, right, if all of those external structures break down, what are people ultimately going to be able to do? It's always that kind of scary thing when you consider it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's an interesting one because, like, growing up, I grew up on a tiny island in Fiji. And back at home, I knew which direction the birds fly at night. I knew which plants to use if I got a little cut or scratch. I knew where the water was clean and where it was contaminated. So all of these things, you know, to feel the earth on my feet and go, okay, I know which direction I'm moving in. All of those things in a modern society, I live here in Sydney, and I don't get to experience those things. This is a foreign land for me. I don't understand the plants. I don't understand the animals. And to me, that is quite foreign. And it feels like a disconnection from the land. So, in the modern world, there is this massive disconnect, not only from the land, but also from our own nature.
Mm. So, yeah, and that obviously makes it really difficult for people to be fully self-reliant. But I think definitely one way to make some inroads into that and a starting point would be to work on ourselves. And that's a really good segue, I think, to our first talking point. Talk to me about, what do you mean by the paradox of the reptilian brain? Now, not everybody's going to be familiar with this idea of the reptilian brain, so maybe mention what that is. And then, of course, you know, let's explore that idea further.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, in my view, the reptilian brain is actually a misnomer. So we understand the human brain as these two fairly advanced cerebral hemispheres. There's two of them, the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere. And we give so much, I guess, precedence to these two hemispheres. And below it, we have the subcortical structures, and we call that the midbrain. And even below that is what we call the hindbrain structures, things like the medulla oblongata or the cerebellum. And we call these primitive parts of the brain reptilian. And for me, it doesn't really make sense, because these parts of the brain have had a far more longer period in evolution than the two cerebral hemispheres. So in fact, they are far more sophisticated, far more advanced from an evolutionary perspective than the fairly recently evolved cerebral hemispheres. So for me, this is the paradox. We think we're intelligent because we have these recently developed hemispheres, but for me, the intelligence, especially the intelligence of the body, lies beneath the brain. So that's why I call it the paradox of the reptilian brain.
Oh, I think that's beautiful, and I really appreciate that you pointed that out. I think a lot of people, if they know anything about this idea of the reptilian brain, it's often viewed as something, as you noted, primitive and negative, right? It's something that we should be all afraid of. But I think what you're alluding to is actually the magic of self-reliance, or the magic of learning to manage yourself more effectively in life and deal with stress, is going to come down to how well you're actually able to manage that part of your brain, more so than the kind of the newer part of the brain that everybody talks about, where, you know, we're the rational creature and that's where our logic lives.
Yeah, absolutely. So I do understand the bad rap that the so-called reptilian hindbrain or primitive brain gets, because I think it was in the 1970s when I think it was a psychologist called Joseph Ledoux who came up with the hypothesis of the amygdala. And since then, psychology has been based on the amygdala hijack hypothesis, which is basically when you face a threat, the amygdala fires and then suddenly going to fight or flight. And the response you get is a very narrow-minded tunnel vision approach to looking at reality. So, you know, anxiety, panic, and all of those things are associated with that amygdala hijack hypothesis. But if you consider something else, which is the basic premise of all of these theories, is based on the fact that fear overrides our intelligence. But when you dive deeper, especially deeper into the nervous system below the level of the brain, especially when you start looking at the nervous system itself, what I call the autonomic nervous system, which is how all the organ systems function, fear literally becomes a biological lie. It prevents very basic functions from happening in the body, and it takes over and starts controlling not only all of our organ systems, but our cognitive processes as well. And so when we see the world through the microscope of fear, the reality feels very, very distorted. But if we return back to the organ systems and learn how to manage internally, then a higher intelligence starts to arise, and starts with the organs itself, learning how your instincts work, learning how things like intuition work. So all of these things are inbuilt into our own nervous system, but we rarely get taught what it is, let alone use it in our daily lives.
So if I understand correctly, what you're really saying there is that what's important is that we learn to manage our nervous system before we concern ourselves with trying to change our psychology.
Yeah, absolutely. So if I break it down even further, we can look at this in three stages. The first stage is the mind, where strategies are developed, and most of the strategies are scaffolding from the past to protect us from, you know, threats, danger, pain, things that we have used for self-preservation, and it eventually builds the anatomy of the ego. If we dive a little bit deeper, then we have the unconscious, I separate the unconscious from the subconscious. The unconscious for me is, again, all the stories that we build around our existence. The subconscious for me is anatomical, so I can talk about subcortical structures in the brain, and the amygdala, hippocampus, all of these structures that are below the two hemispheres I refer to as the subconscious. And then we can dive even deeper into the nervous system. So instead of looking at strategies of the mind or stories of the unconscious, we can look at the biology and the mechanism that the nervous system functions in. So this is our state. So we have strategies, we have stories, and then we have our internal state. And the state of our body only has two states. It's actually binary. It's either fight or flight or parasympathetic state. So it makes it very, very simple. So when we learn how to maintain our nervous system in a, not just in a parasympathetic state, the key is to be able to navigate between these two states seamlessly. When we learn how to do that, it makes all the other processes work much more efficiently. So this is where I guess the hardwiring is, but instead of looking at the hardwiring of the body, we start hotwiring all these connections in our brain and try to, you know, function in a reasonable manner, but we haven't changed the hardwiring.
One of the things, maybe before we go a little bit deeper into that, coming from where you came from, you said you came from a small little island in Fiji. Would you say that there's a difference between people that are really connected to the land and their understanding of this? They might not be able to define it in scientific terms, and I get that, but their understanding of how to manage their nervous system versus, say, a modern person. Would you say there's a difference? Do you think that they have it more keyed in, they really understand it, and where we've maybe have lost that ability because of how we live in the modern world, which is so far removed from how our ancestors lived on the planet for most of our existence?
Yeah, very much. I think when you look into primitive societies, you get a window into the past, into our ancestry, into the primitive forms of existence, perhaps dating before agriculture even. So a lot of what drives this society is not external input. It is the connection with the tribe. The tribe needs to sustain itself, and we can't do it without the other members in the community. And if you look at the Western society, it's often every man for himself. We go to school, we try to be better than the student sitting next to us. We go to work, and we, you know, the process of getting through job interviews and things like that, we're all competing from the onset. Even in Australia right now, even before a child is born, the parents have to find out which school the kid will be enrolled in and move to that suburb. And, you know, it's like the kid hasn't even been born and you're already trying to design their life. So this isn't a holistic form or in any way an integrated form of living. When we live in harmony with ourselves and with the people around us, the relationship we have with the land is very, very different. And so in Western society, we have almost let that slide, and we started living in terms of the key metrics for success is very, very different. So wealth, relationship, status, all of these things are very isolating. And in societies where I have grown up in, I've also explored societies in Papua New Guinea. I've gone deep into the Amazon. I've gone into Africa, I think 6 different countries in Africa, and I've seen how they live, and they don't have for example, concept of land ownership. If, for example, a family has the head of the family die, that land then returns back to the earth. There is no ownership of it. And if another person walks over and goes, I can use this land, the village basically grants them that opportunity to make use of that land. So a lot of structures that have been developed in society today is very, very isolating. And I do feel that affects, especially the emotional connection we have with ourselves, with the people around us, and with the environment itself.
So coming back then to this idea of what we can do in the modern world to reinvoke that the intelligence of the hardwired aspect of our being, right? That's really what you're talking about. And you mentioned the idea of the autonomic nervous system, the two components to that being the sympathetic, which is your fight and flight response, and then your parasympathetic, which is your homeostasis, your calming side. What are some of the ways that you are approaching getting people to regulate their nervous system more effectively? Because I think you can speak to this, I'm sure, but it's not just all negative, right? The fight and flight response, again, gets a whole bad rap. But in actual fact, we also need that in order to achieve the things that we need to achieve in life. So it's not just one for the other. But I would say, and you probably agree with this, unfortunately, the way that we live and the way that we interact with these unnatural stresses in our lives really creates this sympathetic overdominance that most people are struggling with. And so there is something to be said about getting that parasympathetic system back in alignment and at least balancing out, you know, the way that most people are feeling, which is on a constant treadmill of anxiety.
Yeah, you're absolutely right there, Rodney. So basically, when the fight or flight mechanism is on overdrive, if you look at the organ systems, they're not cooperating anymore. We have the metabolic rate that is risen above the baseline. A lot of the energy resources are going into the adrenals, into the thyroid to harvest energy from the body instead of rest and repair, which the body is normally doing. That energy is being diverted away, and so recovering from illnesses is a lot harder. Repair mechanisms, aging actually speeds up, and so the eloquent balance really is the ability to switch between fight or flight and the parasympathetic state seamlessly. So we can measure this scientifically, and the way we do this is through heart rate variability. So what you would want is to have high heart rate variability. The moment the heart rate rises because of some threat, you can experience that threat. But also when the threat passes, you want your heart rate to come back down. But because we don't get taught how to do this, the heart rate remains high. And if, for example, the threat has passed, because the heart rate remains high, it affects our mood. If it affects, perhaps even the whole day might go by and we may maintain a rapid heart rate. So the state in that case is predominantly fight or flight. If you have high heart rate variability, the heart rate rises because of a threat, and then the moment the threat subsides, your heart rate decelerates back to baseline, and that is what is optimal. And so this switching between states is what we don't get taught. We kind of shame the fight or flight mechanism. We shame anxiety. We shame the destructive states of the body and also our mentality. But we don't get shown how to navigate through it in a harmonious way. So that balance is missing.
I think for some people listening to that, maybe explain, what do you mean by heart rate variability? I know what it means, but I suppose if somebody's never heard that term before, they're like, what does that mean? So what actually is the difference between when you say high heart rate variability is a good place to be versus a heart rate where it's up because of threats or stress or perceived, you know, threats? What's that difference?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So heart rate variability is basically the moment-to-moment fluctuation in the peak-to-peak heart rate. So, for example, the first heartbeat could be 450 milliseconds. The second heartbeat could be 612 milliseconds. The third heartbeat could be 520 milliseconds. And that variability, that moment-to-moment fluctuation, is what we call heart rate variability. If, for example, you're at work and maybe you receive a nasty email from your superiors and your heart rate rises, by the time you finish that reading that email, if your heart rate remains high, then you have low heart rate variability because it changes. It has changed state, but it hasn't been able to switch back. But if you read this this email and your heart rate rises, which is a good thing, you're feeling threatened. And then after reading that email, your heart rate calms down. Then you're able to look at the same scenario with another light, not through the tunnel vision of fear, but then you're able to see, what is this person saying here, and look at it from a more objective objective eyes rather than just through the tunnel vision of fear. So this is what it means to have high heart rate variability, to be able to have your heart rate rise very quickly, but then decelerate just as quickly. So that's high heart rate variability. If it's low, then you get locked into one of these states.
I mean, obviously, it's not 100% accurate. You're just giving as an example. You were saying about the milliseconds between the heart rates, right? Well, that's, I'm assuming, is the beat of the heart. What would then be that space between the two heartbeats when you are dealing with high stress, right? When you're in that kind of stressed out and you just, your heart rate rises. Is there a difference there? Well, what are we looking at insofar as if we could look, I mean, it's difficult to I guess, get it across when we're talking, but if I had to visually see it, what would that difference be?
In terms of like the heart rate variability?
Yeah, so how do we make that distinction, right? So we say, okay, when I'm faced with a stress, my heart rate's gonna rise. How does that picture look different to when you say that you're actually in a high heart rate variability, which is actually where you want to be? Is there a difference in the pattern? If I was looking at it on a screen, how would I know the difference? Because I know, for example, and you might know about this, there's that organization called HeartMath, and they have the different ways of looking at your heart rate on a screen. How does that actually look? How do I think sometimes what I'm trying to say is that people get stressed out all the time. They don't even know that they're stressed out anymore. You know, so they get so used to it because the body is so adaptable at dealing with these things that if you ask somebody sometimes like, hey, are you stressed out? They're, no, I'm not. I'm perfectly fine.
Yeah. So there's a few things going on there as well. So if, and I know this is very common in society that people who live in high stress environments think it's fairly normal to be in that state. Some people are quite excited all the time, and their nervous system basically is fried. But because that is familiar to them, they think that is normal. In terms of how this looks if we were measuring this in say an electrocardiogram, high heart rate variability is basically changes that are quite rapid in peak-to-peak variability. Your heart rate, you know, it could go up to, say 100 beats per minute. And then how quickly does it decelerate back down to, say, 72 beats per minute or back down to 60 beats per minute? If that deceleration is quick, then we say it is high heart rate variability. if it takes a longer refractory period, then we say the heart rate variability is low. So I hope that makes it a little bit more clearer.
No, that answers the question perfectly. So that, I mean, even as you were saying that, I could see that in my mind's eye, how that would actually look. So that, you know, that's kind of what I was getting at. What is the link between instinct and flow? So what is that link when we start talking about instinct and flow? Because I think a lot of what we've been talking about up until this point is this hardwired system that you're talking about, but that's also our instinct. And if we manage that more effectively, we are more than likely, and this is my experience, to experience more flow in our lives.
Yeah, absolutely. So the traditional idea of flow actually comes from Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, who's probably got around 200 different publications on this topic. But his idea of flow is the fact that the challenge and your abilities have a direct correlation. So if the challenge is too high, you won't be able to enter flow. But if the challenge is too low, then there's not enough stress to engage instinct to enter flow. So if you take surfing, for example, if the surfer is inexperienced, then they're in the waves and they're getting smashed by it. But if the surfer is experienced and a challenging wave arrives, it gives them the thrill because the instincts take over in that moment and they have that beautiful wave that carries them through and they experience this thrill of flow. Mm-hmm. So flow in my definition is the visceral harmony that we experience in direct proportion to our connection to this moment. So it in my view, it actually does not require any external input. We can enter flow by learning how to tap into our instincts without an external threat or an external stress. And this is quite different from what Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi might talk about. So the idea is that our instincts have been, I guess, hijacked to the point where we don't even know that we have them. And to give you an example, there's so many things that happen biologically that we are not even aware of. For example, I'm just going to have this candle holder right here. So hopefully you can see that. This has a little bit of weight. It's made out of crystals. And if I lift this with my arm, the other hand remains where it is. But if someone else were to come up and lift this off my arm, there would be an upward perturbation of my hand because of it. And that is because the visual feedback has a bit of latency by the time it corrects the upward perturbation. When I do it myself, the information from my right hand goes up into my brain, gets inverted and gets translated into a downward force on my left hand so that hand doesn't move. So there's so many different instincts that are hardwired into our own body and we're not even aware of it. Another one is the idea that we can't tickle ourselves. Basically the same thing is happening. The sensory stimulation from, say, me tickling myself is being canceled out by my own nervous system so that I don't involuntarily stimulate myself by tickling myself. So all of these things are inbuilt into the nervous system, and we can actually take some of these instincts and use it to our own benefit. Breathing, for example, is also a reflex, it's an instinct. And because breathing is so intimately linked to our own heart rates, we can use it to modulate our own hearts. and therefore the rest of the nervous system. So by training the breathing cycles, we can tap into how the nervous system behaves under threat. And that is really, really powerful. So that's a whole other topic in itself, but that's in a nutshell.
Yeah, no, I love that. I mean, what you're really saying, and I think this comes back to what we started off as, where we were talking about being self-reliant, is that really what it is, stop looking outside of yourself, look in, and the answers are already there. It's just that we, in the modern world, have forgotten what those answers are. And that really speaks to this instinct aspect that you are putting forward.
Yeah, exactly. And the moment you learn how to modulate your instincts and start learning how to train them, then flow becomes a natural part of life. You're not being, I guess, steered away from the strength that is already within your own body. Instead, your instincts take over, especially in moments of stress. And instead of the self-preserving behavior that normally happens when we go into fear, there's a sense of openness, there's a sense of creativity, there's other higher faculties that tap in, like compassion and courage, that allow you to respond very, very differently to what would traditionally happen when someone is threatened or when someone is in fear. And so this is where, you know, greater wisdom arises. And because we don't get taught this, often when we get threatened, we, I guess, descend down into our self-preservation mechanisms. And even though we think they're there to protect us, it often leads to far more destructive pathways than what is available to us when we actually tap into the true strength of our instincts.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about and just get your view on this, my research as a social scientist was focused on this idea of mindfulness, and I'm sure you're aware of it, so I'd like to hear what you feel about that. But what I realized early on as I started researching is that mindfulness is great, but what I decided to do was take an embodied approach, because I realized that although mindfulness is very powerful, it's only part of the story. And really what you're talking about is very similar and in line with my work. Actually, this weekend I taught at a mindfulness get together that happens on the Isle of Man, where I happen to be right now. And I really made the point in my practical sessions where I was using the body to teach them how to, quote unquote, manage their nervous system more effectively. And sure, mindfulness was a component of that in order to make them more aware of what was actually going on. But I really entered this whole process through the body and not just as a cognitive, you know, thinking oriented approach.
Yeah, you literally hit the nail on the head there, Rodney. It's I do believe mindfulness has its place, especially in terms of making us self-aware, becoming aware of our own thoughts. But that is only very surface level awareness. The deeper understanding actually goes beyond all of that. So I've worked for many, many years in this area. And I, for example, meditation teachers come to me, yoga teachers come to me, and some of them have been doing their practice for well over 20 years, not just practicing, but teaching for well over 20 years. And when I put a heart rate monitor on them and look at what their state is when they're relaxed and what their state is when I put them under stress, often they're able to relax when there is no stress. So when, you know, there's a room lit with candles and scent sticks and all of that, but the moment you have stress in the equation, then they're not able to maintain that calm and relaxed state. And that is where we actually need it the most. And so what good it what good is it to practice something that only works in an ideal scenario? So to give you another analogy, it's like when you look at, say, the Olympics, athletes trained very, very specifically to perform a very specific function on a environment that is completely ideal. It's designed for their best performance, but that is not real life. Instead, when you're training for the worst case scenarios, say what the military does, in those circumstances, they don't know what is going to happen, but they are training their body to respond to the worst case scenario. And I think that is much, much better. So unless you are also accommodating your mindfulness practice with a body-based practice that is working with real-time stress, that is working with real-time challenges, your practice is lacking in a way that it only functions in ideal scenarios.
So I don't know if you noticed when you were talking there, I was smiling a lot because it's kind of interesting to me. Two things there. First thing is, I've been very fortunate and honored to work with many special force military units around the world. And one of the reasons they bring me out is exactly that, to talk about how they can manage those really high risk situations more effectively. And the entire experience that I take them through is through the body. And it's something that they want, and they realize how important that really is. Although they've already done a lot of work in that area, of course, anybody in that kind of world wants to get even 1% better. Then when I take that out of that environment and I bring it into everyday life, like at the event that I talked at and taught at on the weekend, there's resistance there. Because so much of what people are doing, and I ask them, I say, how many of you have a meditation practice? They all put up their hands. I say, well, how many of you, when you're doing meditation, how many times are you in this quiet room with a candle, you know, lights are turned down or lights are off, you've got the wafting of the incense and everybody puts up their hand. I go, well, how many of you agree that experience is what life is like? Nobody puts up their hand, right? I said, well, it's interesting, right? It's one thing to be calm, centered, and focused in that kind of environment, but life isn't like that. And so exactly as you said, what relevance is that practice then if I can't take what I'm achieving on the Zafu, on the meditation cushion, that relaxed state, and bring it over into my life when I really need it, right? And so I think this is where I see the disconnect happening all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things that I teach is evoking the nervous system's natural response to calm down under pressure, but doing it in real time, because the moment you get stressed, what if stress could be a trigger for relaxation rather than the traditional fight or flight response? And if that is the case, then when you get stressed, your nervous system has the ability to calm you down in a time when it matters the most, rather than some ideal hypothetical scenario, which you think might work, but in real life, everything just, you know, disintegrates, and then you have to go back into a meditation practice to overcome what happened in reality. So rather than wasting time dealing with the situation in retrospect, why not deal with it in real time?
I love that. That just makes so much sense to me, and that's been my experience. So as we come to the end here, Koushik, what I wanted to hear from you is some final words of inspiration. What would you want to leave people with who are listening to this talk?
One of the key messages that I talk about is being able to relax down into the parasympathetic state allows you to have a deeper connection with yourself. And that is because when your heart rate variability is high, you're able to switch between states and remain calm and centered. And that builds the connection with your own self. You are in tune with what you want. You have the strength and courage to say what you want. And if you're being steered in the wrong direction, you're able to pause and say, actually, that is not what I want. And not only does that strengthen your own confidence and your own ability to respond to what is happening around you, it also builds trust and respect to those who are around you. So in fact, it is heightening your sense of self. It is heightening the love that you have within yourself and therefore with everyone else as well, because they love and respect you for who you are. And so one of the key things and the eloquent message that I want to share is that you cannot love in a hurry. The moment the heart rate rises and you're running around trying to juggle so many things but can't pay attention to what is happening right now, you have lost that connection with yourself and therefore with love itself.
To learn more about the art of self-reliance, our virtual coaching service, online courses, and our retreats in Thailand, head over to PrimalSkills, that's with a Z.com.